What we're doing in this series of messages is looking at the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is about creation and about how things began. It tells us that God began everything, and it tells us why he began everything. And and that means we get to some of the most foundational issues there are. In the book of Genesis, we get down to the basic features and aspects of human existence. We get at answers to the big why questions and the what for questions that have plagued us for centuries. And today what we want to look at is one of the things that keeps coming up, words that keep coming up in Genesis 1 and 2, work and rest. And this morning one of my sons came in and said, "Dad, what are you preaching on today?" And I said, "Work." And there was this pause, and I said, "It's more interesting than it sounds." Because, who wants to hear a sermon on work? But you know what? That's an awfully relevant subject, especially to people in this room, especially if you live or work in New York. Early on in my, when we first got here, early on in our time in New York, and I don't remember who I was talking to. I just remember the words. I don't remember the speaker. But I remember I was complaining about the fact that, I'm working so hard. I'm just working much harder than I ever worked in any other ministry anywhere else. And I just remember, I think it was a man, he looked at me and he said, "Well, nobody comes to New York to get a life." If you come to New York, you come to work. If you don't come to work, you might as well leave. And, there's a lot of, for at least 150 years, that's absolutely true. Immigrants come to New York and try to get into this whole new American society. And how do they do it? How do they enter into this new American society? Through an enormous amount of work. And then there's hundreds of thousands, maybe not millions of immigrants, but hundreds of thousands of people who live in America, or already in American society, come to New York in order to make it into one of the professions, and to make it in their career, and make it in their field. And of course that means everybody's working, but I'll tell you, somebody in the last 5 to 10 years has turned it up several notches, and not just in New York. Something's going on with work in this culture. Something's going on. The 40-hour work week, what was that? Do you remember that? Do you remember when we actually did have 5 days shalt thou labor and 2 days off? We don't know what it is. And I mean, I'm reading all sorts of things. I'm reading it's the new economy. I'm reading it's technology, cell phones, email. There's all sorts of villains. I don't know what the villains are, but something's going on. Probably the main villain we're going to talk about here today. It's not technological. It's not sociological. It's emotional and spiritual and theological. But something's going on. Work is becoming a personal spiritual crisis issue. Remember when you used to just eat when you ate? Is there anybody in New York that only eats when they eat? I never eat when I don't just eat when I eat. I'm always doing something else. You feel like you're wasting time if you just eat when you eat. You do something else when you eat. Do you remember the rhythms? There was rhythms of work and rest and work and rest. We worked in the day. We rested in the evening. We worked in the week. We rested on the weekends. And that's all gone. There's no rhythms left. Something's going on. The rhythms are gone of work and rest. The neighborhoods are gone. Nobody ever sees anyone else. Families, in many senses, are gone. Something's going on with work. And yet here in Genesis 1 and 2, I told you it's more interesting than it sounds at first. Genesis 1 and 2 is saying, because work and rest come up in the very beginning of things, Genesis is saying that getting and understanding work and rest is at the very heart of things. It's at the very essence of living a human life. Understanding work and rest is a life and death issue. So what do we learn here about work and rest? And let's lay it out like this. The text is teaching us, first of all, what we're called to do, which is work, and how we're called to do it. But then lastly, what we need in order to do it. What we're called to do, and how we're called to do it, but what we desperately need in order to do it. And the answer to that, of course, is rest. You're never going to work unless you get rest. But that's a much more profound statement in Genesis and in the Bible than it sounds the way I just put it. Let's look at these three things. What we're called to do, how we're called to do it, and what we need in order to get it done. Number one, what we're called to do. First thing we see here is that when we're made, in the very beginning, we're called to work. Again, I had to apologize to my son this morning by saying, I know that doesn't sound all that exciting, but actually there is something radically stunning and exciting and positive about what this text tells us about work. First thing we see, look at verse 2:2. It says, when God, this is the very seventh day, by the seventh day God had finished the work he'd been doing. Do you know how radical that is? Do you know, as one of the commentaries I was reading said, do you realize what an intellectually radical statement this was when this was written? If you look to Eastern accounts of creation, I mentioned, I think, last week, the Enuma Elish. That's a famous Babylonian account of creation. And in that account, there's a battle of the gods, and Marduk, the king of the victorious group, creates the world as a kind of monument to his victory. And Marduk is creating the world by slitting open the body of the god that he destroyed. And he creates the heavens and the earth. And all the other gods come in, and he says, now we're going to live in this. We can come and go into this new world, this universe I'm creating. And they say, do you realize what it'll take to keep that up? We're afraid if we go in there, we're going to end up, you know, having to keeping up the world. It'll be an awful lot of work. And Marduk says, oh, I know it. And this is what he says in the Enuma Elish. He says, I will bring into being a lowly primitive creature called man. Man shall be his name, and to him shall be charged the labor, so that the gods may have rest. So you see, in the Enuma Elish, in the Eastern accounts of creation, work is completely bad. Gods don't do work. Let humans do work, so we can rest. Completely different than this, but let's go on the other side. On the other side, let's look at Western ancient accounts. Look at the Greeks and the Romans. There's a number of great myths the Greeks have about origins, and one of the most famous is Pandora's box. You know that Zeus gives Pandora this jar, actually, this box we call it today, and says, don't you open it. And she opens it, and what comes out? All the bad things, everything that's wrong. Death, disease, decay, and work. See, in the Greek myth, work is in Pandora's box. Work comes out with death and disease and everything else. Now, what is going on here? Genesis 1 is almost deliberately going in the teeth, right in the teeth of what both Western and Eastern, what everybody else ever thought about work. It's saying work is something God does. Work is something good. In fact, what's really astounding is look at chapter 2, verse 7. The Lord formed God, the man, from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Now, we all know, do we not? Or let me remind you of what you learned in school. The Greeks and the Romans understood the soil as being bad. The physical as being bad. The soul is good. You see, the soul is good. The soil is bad. Listen carefully. The soul is good. The body's bad. The body is the prison house of the soul. And Xenophon and Cicero and Socrates and everybody taught that manual work, therefore, was demeaning. Work was bad as it was. It was a curse. It was in Pandora's box. It was not something good. It was a curse. It's a punishment. But if you have to work, stay out of the dirt. You don't do manual work. Even, by the way, Socrates said, even retail is demeaning. He says what you want to do is to avoid work completely or else be a teacher or be a philosopher. Get into the information industry, basically, is what Socrates said. And here what we have is, almost deliberately, the book of Genesis shows us God with dirt under his fingernails. God digging a ditch in order to create us. And then, of course, in 2:15, God plants a garden, God has his hands dirty, and then he puts us and says, you be a gardener. Now, all this is so radical. All this is unbelievably radical. Genesis going out of his way to say, look how good work is. Work is in the paradise. Here's paradise, the Garden of Eden, paradise. And what's in there? Great food. You see that? Beautiful things for the eye to look at. So you have food, and you have beauty, and you have, as we're going to see, you have spirituality. They walk with God in the cool of the garden. And you had sexuality, and you had friendship, and work. Work is put in paradise. Not only work is put in paradise, not only is work not a punishment, but all work is held up. Even what we call today menial work, manual work. No matter how high and lofty your position is in society today, Your ancestor was a groundskeeper. In other words, if you have this huge house at the Hamptons, you know those people, you don't even know their names, who take care of your grounds? That's your cousin. That's your ancestor. That's your father. See? There has never been, except for one person I know, there's never been another major thinker, there's never been another major thought form that had this high view, not only of work, but of all work. And all workers. So that even, you know, the gardener, even the menial ditch digger, you know, is held up like this. The only person who had this high view of work was Karl Marx. Karl Marx says the worker, the common worker, he held him up. But you see, here's the problem. Marxism is deeply discredited today, is it not? Completely out. Why? I would suggest it's because Marx didn't ground his high view of work in a God who loves to get his hands dirty and a God with his hands in the dirt. He didn't ground this high view of work in the love of a God whose son came, not as the Greeks would expect him to come as a philosopher, or as the Romans would expect him to come as a noble statesman, or as the Jews wanted him to come as a great general, but as a carpenter. A union guy, okay? Marx didn't ground it in that. Marx basically grounded his high view of work in atheism. And you know, one of his contemporaries, Dostoevsky, who was a little more philosophically astute, said, if there is no God, everything is permitted. If there's just evolution, what's wrong with oppression? And there's no warrant for saying there's anything wrong with oppressing the workers. But you see, now that Marxism is pretty much passé, where is the source of social healing in this world? Where is it? Look at Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 1 and 2 says, ditch digging lifts it up. Music, because Genesis 1, we looked at this last week, was a song. Genesis 1 and 2 is theology and philosophy. Don't you remember in the killing fields, when the workers got in charge in Cambodia, what did they do? They took the professionals and they killed them. They marched them out. Remember the killing fields? In our global capitalistic economy now, it's the unskilled manual workers who are disdained. Professionals are disdained in communism, and menial workers are disdained in capitalism, but in the Bible, all work has dignity because God does it. There's nothing more socially healing than to believe what the Bible tells us, and that is, we are called to work, and we're called to all work. All work is a calling of God. All work has dignity. All work is satisfying to something God put in us. Well, let's get to that. And by the way, is there anybody who right now has a job that's considered menial? Is there anybody, are any of you parents that are spending an awful lot of time at home with your fingers in baby poop? And have you imbibed what the our new economy tells you, and that is, this is not a job for anybody but a boob? Remember the God with dirt under his fingernails, who dignifies all work. And by the way, especially that work. But anyway, so the first thing is we're called to work. We're called to all kinds of work. Very radical. But then secondly, I'm going to give you, briefly, three things in here, three practical guidelines for how we should do our work. We're not only called, what are we called to do work? How are we called to do it? There are three guidelines here for working happily, for grounding our work in what the Bible tells us the nature of things is. There's three guidelines, and I'll just tell them to you quickly and then go through them quickly. This also works, by the way, for being happy in the job you choose, and also works in being happy in working the job you've chosen or the job you have. There's three things we're told here. Look in, look out, and look up. Look in at what you're gifted to do. Look out at what people need. And look up to the one who's called you. Look in, work because of who you are, or what you're gifted to do. Number two, look out, look at the world around you, and give the world what it needs to have. And look up, look at the one who's called you, and realize you have to realize what you're destined to be. You need all three of those things. Those are your three guidelines for work. Let me show you how quickly that goes. Number one, look in. Chapter 1, verse 26. God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, let them rule. Now why? He's a ruler. He makes us in his image, and he makes us rulers. Now, what's this mean? We are all made in the image of a creator, and therefore we need to create. Now, this doesn't mean we all have to be artists. And as a matter of fact, listen carefully. We said last week that the Hebrew word create, which means to create out of nothing, is a word that's only used three times in the book in Genesis 1 and 2, and it's only ever used in the Bible of God. But there's a lot of other words like form and make and shape and separate that are not only used of God, but of us. Because creation proper is making something totally new out of no matter at all. Only God can do that. But subcreation, that's the word that J.R.R. Tolkien came up with, subcreation means making something relatively new out of existing material. Subcreation is doing what the Spirit does in chapter 1, verse 2, which we looked at last week. The Spirit hovers over the empty void matter. And what is the Spirit doing? The Spirit's bringing order out of chaos. The Spirit is bringing newness out of undeveloped material. And every human being has a deep desire in some way to image or reflect that. You were made in the image of a creator, and you've got to do it. What do I mean? For example, if you create a business, you're taking disparate elements, human elements, and you're creating a business that wasn't there before or a product that wasn't there before. That's business. Number two, you take disparate physical elements and you create a work of art, a painting or sculpture or something like that. What have you done? Number three, you take over a terrible organization or an awful department which is sinking and losing money and you turn it into something stable and productive again and the jobs are saved. What have you done? Number four, you're a teacher and you're bringing the kids' potential out. Because you're such a good teacher, you're bringing the kids' greatest potential out. You're giving them a vision. You're bringing out their abilities. You're showing them what they can do. What are you doing? Okay. You see? Number five, you're a medical professional and you take a disordered body and you make it orderly. A body that's sinking and falling apart and you bring it together. Or you're a therapist or a counselor and you take a disorderly life and you bring order out of it. You see? Or what if you just love cleaning up the yard? What if you love hairstyling? What is it? Combing the hair. What are you doing when you're bringing the comb through? You are doing what the Spirit did. The Spirit brings order out of chaos, and you need to do that. Why is it so satisfying to get a job done well? Whether it's business, or whether it's teaching, or whether it's counseling, or whether it's medicine, or whether it's management, or whether it's groundskeeping, or whether it's domestic engineering, whether it's cleaning up your own house, whether it's running a comb through somebody's hair. What are you doing? Exactly what the Spirit did. Bringing order out of chaos, bringing something new, and you need that. And everybody has gifts to do that. And you've got to look inside, you've got to find out what your gifts are, and you've got to work. You've got to do it, or you won't feel human. There's been a number of really interesting articles in the New York Times recently. Just last week, there was one in the New York Times Magazine about affluenza. Do you know what affluenza is? Sudden wealth syndrome? There was an article in the, during the summertime about the kids whose parents worked for the money and then they inherit it. And what all the articles are trying to say is this. If you have the Pandora box view of work, that it's a curse, and you say, finally, I don't have to work, it won't be long before you'll feel this deep disorientation to your very humanity. You'll feel like your own uselessness is just choking you. You've got gifts. You're made in the image of a creator, and you've got to create. You've got to make. So look inside and find a job that fits. Your gifts, your talents, those ways in which you image the Spirit, which you image the Creator. That's number one. Look in. Number two, though, look out. Because look at verse 15 of chapter 2. It says, the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Not just work it. Not just use it. Take care of it. And this is the issue of stewardship. Now, I know that a lot of you, because you're modern, you live in a modern, or maybe postmodern, individualistic, contemporary Western society, you really grooved on the first of these guidelines, didn't you? You said, yes, find work that fits my gifts. Find work that fits my heart. Something's been put in me that needs to create, needs to produce, needs to... I get into that. I like that. I want to do that. But here's the second part. The second part is, do not only find work that fulfills you, but find work that helps people. Find work for the common good. Find work that the world needs. You are stewards of the people around you. You've been given gifts for them. Now, here's the way the average New Yorker says, great, I'll find a job that fits my gifts, and I'll make as much money as I possibly can, then I'll give it away. And of course, that's one way. That's the second way to do stewardship. And that's important, very important. If you make a great deal of money, you're still a steward. You're here to care for the world that God's given us and for the people around you. And if you have the talents, by the way, which you did not ask for, you did not earn, you did not merit it. For example, today, if you live in a situation, if you've got math skills and it makes you incredibly, incredibly wealthy because you know how to use those in a society that values technology and values finance, rather than people skills, which means that you change bedpans and you become a therapist or a nurse or something and you make very little money, if you just happen to have the gifts that in this particular time and place, because you were born here and not on a mountain in Tibet in the 13th century, because you're born here, you get rich, don't you think that it came to you? Don't you think that you earned it? Of course you didn't earn it. Your talents just happen to work out in such a way that you make money. Then make sure that you're generous with that money, incredibly generous, because it was given to you. But why wait till then to be a good steward? Why not take some jobs now that don't earn as much money but do an awful lot of good for people? Why not just use the garden, not just use the garden, but care for it? And the second thing you've got to do, you have to look in, but then you have to look out. What do people need? What do people need? Am I producing something that helps society? Am I producing something that helps people? That's the second thing. But lastly, look up. It's not enough just to look in and look out. It's not enough just to find a job that fits me and a job that helps people. Oh, no. There has to be a sense that you're on a mission. John Coltrane was one of the great saxophonists of the 20th century. And he was converted in 1957, and it transformed his view of work. He wrote some tremendous jazz, which was like, for example, A Love Supreme, which was just an ecstatic outpouring of praise and thanks to Christ. He was one of the great saxophonists. He played with Dizzy Gillespie, he played with Miles Davis, and on the liner notes of A Love Supreme, back I think really in the 60s, he said this. He says, "During the year 1957, I experienced by the grace of God a spiritual awakening which was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life. At that time, in gratitude, I humbly asked to be given the means and privilege to make others happy through my music, and I feel this has been granted through His grace. All praise to God." John Coltrane, in the liner notes. And one day, he played A Love Supreme. He was doing it himself as a solo, and it was the best solo. It was an incredible piece of music. It was an unbelievable rendition. And when it was over, he stepped off the podium and he put his sax down, and for the people around him, he heard him say, "Nunc dimittis." You know what "nunc dimittis" means? It's the first two Latin words in the famous prayer of Simeon in Luke chapter 2, where Simeon says, "Now lettest thy servant depart in peace according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation." And here's what he's saying. He says, "I can go now. I was put on earth to do a certain amount of things, to write a certain amount of music, to play certain things. I was put on earth to do some things, and I've done it." See, where did he get that poise? Not just by looking inside saying, "Oh, well, you know, I've got the talent to be a musician." Not just by looking out and saying, "In general, I want to make the world to be a better place." He was called. He knew he was called. Ephesians 2, verse 8 and 9 and 10 is fascinating. Verse 10 says this, "We are God's workmanship, created by God to do good deeds, which He has prepared beforehand for us to accomplish." John Coltrane says, "I know that there are certain people I need to help. There are certain things I'm here to do." And at a certain point, he realized he'd done them. He had a sense of accomplishment. Do you see these three things? A, you look inside and realize God's given me something to do. B, you look outside and say, and I'm in the place where I need to find a job that'll, you know, be productive to other people. And if I offer up that job based on my gifts and based on the needs of others to God, I know whatever I choose, that God's going to use it. That I'm going to be like a fingerprint. I'm going to be as unique as a fingerprint. There are certain things I have to do, and there are certain people I have to help, and there are certain accomplishments I have to accomplish that only I can accomplish. And you know you're on a mission, and you don't worry about whether you're on a mission or not. You just know. I've chosen a job that fits. I looked in, I looked out, and because I'm looking up, God's going to use me. If you work like that, you'll be happy. If you take jobs that don't fit your gifts and don't help anybody else, but they just get you up the social ladder. If you take a job that fits you and even helps other people, but there's no sense that you're on a mission. In other words, if you have all three of these things, you'll be happy in choosing a job, and you'll be happy in the job you've chosen. Now, lastly, we're not only taught here what we're called to do and how we're called to do it, but now some of you are out there getting pretty grumpy, maybe. And you're saying, this is utopian. This is unrealistic. Now, by the way, I know you're right. Here, I'll tell you why. I have the best job, I know. Far better than any job I ever thought I'd ever get. And I know what you know, and that is even the very, very best jobs are unbelievably frustrating and sometimes terribly crushing and filled with all kinds of difficulty and anxiety. And you say, you haven't painted to me a realistic picture of how to work in this world. Work has been nothing but frustrating to me. Work has hurt me. Work has destroyed me. I would do anything I could just to get out of work altogether or to get into a different kind of work. You're not being realistic, but the Bible is. Maybe I haven't been so far. The Bible is. Because the Bible is utterly realistic and says, yes, 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 you're never going to do the work you're called to. You're never going to be able to do it in this way unless you see what you've got to have in your heart of hearts in order to do work. What do you have to do? You have to rest. Now listen, God, chapter 2, verse 2, finished his work, and then he rested. And then, of course, it goes on, though we don't have it printed here, he hallowed the seventh day. It means he set it apart for us. And if you only had Genesis 1 and 2, what you would be thinking is this. It's like God is saying, you can't do your work well unless you rest. And therefore work so much and then rest and have a rhythm of rest and work. And we say, well, that makes sense. Physically, you need a rhythm of rest and work. Society needs a rhythm of rest and work. But the Bible tells us that there's more to that than meets the eye. If you really, truly want to be able to work the way I'm telling you, you need the real Sabbath rest. Psalm 95. You go to the end of Psalm 95, it's all about worship. It's the famous Psalm, Venite. Come, let us worship. And when you get to the very end, suddenly, shockingly, it says, so listen to God's voice and don't harden your heart as your fathers did in the wilderness when God said, you will never enter my rest. And if you go to Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, it says there still is a rest for the people of God. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. It has everything to do with work. There's a place in Psalm 3 where it says, even though there's 10,000 people on my left and my right, I lay myself down and sleep, and I awake, for the Lord sustains me. Now, the scientists will tell you, it's not the amount of sleep you need, but the depth, right? What do they call that sleep that you've got to have? You know, you could sleep and sleep and sleep for hours, but if you don't get a certain kind of sleep, you'll just go nuts. You won't be able to work. You won't be able to get anything done. What is it called? It's called REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, right? But in Psalm 3, when he says, I've got all these things, all these pressures on me, I lay down and I wake, for the Lord sustains me. He's talking about an REM of the soul. He's talking about a deep rest of the soul. Why does Rocky work? Remember Adrian, he couldn't sleep the night before the big fight. Why did Rocky work? He says, I just got to go the distance. I don't even need to win. I just want to go the distance. Remember what he said to Adrian? Why? Then I'll know I'm not a bum. Why does Madonna work? She tells us in Vogue magazine, which is really one of my favorite quotes, as some of you know. I've used it before. And in Vogue magazine, she says this. She says, every time I accomplish something, I feel like a special human being, but after a little while, I feel mediocre and uninteresting again. I find I have to get myself past this again and again. My drive in life is from the horrible fear of being mediocre. I have to prove I'm somebody. Why did Harold Abrams work? Remember in Chariots of Fire? Or at least, maybe not the literal historical Harold Abrams, but the Harold Abrams that's depicted by the movie Chariots of Fire. Why did he work? Why was he running that 100-yard dash in the Olympics? He says, I got 10 seconds to justify my existence. Now what Rocky, Madonna, and Harold Abrams are showing us is there's a work under the work. Why are they working? They're not just working for a living. They're not just working for money, are they? What are they working for? Stephen Jay Gould put it like this. And he's he was talking about the fact that there is no God, and, you know, this is what he says. He says, we are here simply because one odd group of fish had a peculiar anatomy that just happened to be able to transform itself into legs for terrestrial creatures. We are here just because comets struck the earth and wiped out dinosaurs and gave mammals a chance. We are here just for those reasons. We yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, he says, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating. We have to construct, therefore, any meaning ourselves. Now, he's right. If there is no God, or even if we don't have a relationship with God, how do you know you mean anything? How do you know that you have any worth? How do you know who you are? How do you know that there's anything meaning? Is there any meaning in life? You have to construct it. And how are you going to do it? With your work. And therefore, there's a work under the work. Rocky just needs to know he's not a bum. Madonna just needs to know that she's interesting and not mediocre, that she's somebody. Harold Abraham has to justify his existence. That is what's making your work a mess. You realize what the burden is there? If anything goes wrong with your career, you don't have a self. If anything goes wrong with your, with the money, you don't have a being, you don't have an identity, you don't have a meaning anymore. But you see, back in chapter 2 of Genesis, God cried out with joy, "It is finished." Why? Because he'd finished the work of creation. Centuries later, and essentially the same person cried out again, "It is finished." The first time, God got rest because creation was finished. The second time, Jesus Christ on the cross cried out, "It is finished," so we could get rest. Do you get what I'm talking about? Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9, puts it like this. We who have believed enter that Sabbath rest now. There remains a rest then for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest through faith in Christ rests from his own work just as God did from his. Until you believe that because Jesus Christ died on the cross for you and did everything necessary to fulfill the law of God, until you believe, unlike Stephen Jay Gould, that the person whose approval you really need is God, that the significance you really need is to be significant in God's eyes, that security you really need is to be secure in God's arms, that the approval you really need is to be approved in God's heart, and that what you're doing in work is trying to get that, that's the work under the work that's crushing you and pulling you down, until you understand that. And until you see him not only saying it is finished on the day of creation, but finished on the day of redemption. Not only till you see that the work of creation is finished, which is, gives you a certain amount of rest, but the work of redemption is finished. And until you rest in that, until you know you're not a bum, already before the fight, until you know your existence is justified, already before the race, until you know that who cares if they think you're mediocre and uninteresting, Madonna, if he doesn't. You're not driven anymore, you're not pushed into the ground anymore, and finally you can just work. Work is just about work. It's not about you. It's not about your existence. Finally, you can do things just for their own sake. Do you realize that if you are creating your own meaning in work, the work is never about the work. It's about you. It's never about the people you're helping. It's about you. See, John Coltrane and Madonna, no offense, maybe Madonna's changed her heart since the Vogue interview, I don't know, but John Coltrane said, when he realized that God loved him, it was now about the music and about the people whose pleasure he was giving, you know, through the music. But Madonna actually says, my music's about me. And no wonder it's such a burden. You will never have really good work. You will never be able to work looking in, working out, working up. You'll never have this kind of incredible happiness in work until you realize the work under the work has to be borne by Jesus. Jesus said, come unto me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Why? He gives us rest because he took the burden, the work under the work. He died on the cross for us. He was crushed for our iniquities. He shouldered them. Listen, how do you know if you've got the rest under the work? How do you know you have this deep, rapid eye movement rest so that you can just work? You can choose jobs not because they bring you up and give you a name, because they help people, because they fit your gifts. How can you know that you've really rested in the finished work of Christ? of redemption, not just the finished work of creation. I'll tell you how. You take your time off. What's so interesting is, if you don't take the physical rest, it proves that you don't have the spiritual rest. If you're just working all the time, do you know this rest? Jesus says, come unto me, all who are weak, weary and heavy laden. Gentle am I, humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Let's pray. Give us, Father, this great Sabbath rest that has been promised to us. Help us to see it. Help us to know it. Father, there's a lot of great work to do. We look forward to the day that we can do our art, we can do our teaching, we can do our counseling, we can do our business, we can do our work, and it be about the work, not about us. And it be about you, not about us. And it be about the people around us and not about us. We look forward to a day in which work isn't crushing us into the ground. And we ask, Father, therefore, that you would give us this deep, deep, deep internal rest so that the work and the frustratingness of the work in this world will not any longer just crush us. We ask, Father, therefore, that you would help us to be like your Son, who worked and rested in you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.